You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Milwaukee Brewers open the 2021 season tomorrow at home against the Minnesota Twins. Coming up, we'll find out what the fan experience at American Family Field is expected to look like and what to watch for from the team itself. First, President Biden held a press conference last week where he answered questions from reporters on immigration, the Senate filibuster, and his plans for re-election. It was Biden's first official press conference since taking office. So far, his administration has struck a less confrontational tone with the media than the Trump White House. But it has been criticized lately for lack of transparency at overcrowded immigration shelters near the southern border. Right now, we're looking at what the role of the press is in covering the White House and how it's changed over the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the goal of the media should be in reporting on the presidency? Are journalists that cover the president in particular asking the questions you want to see asked? Do you think we need more transparency from the White House on certain issues, including the current occupant, President Biden? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, no secret, Mike, it was a rocky road for the president and his staff and the media over the last 4 years. What do you think are the big questions facing journalists right now as they start to cover a new non-Donald Trump president?
Well, I think one big question facing journalists is whether they want to return to the way they covered politics before Donald Trump was president or do something different now that Joe Biden is in office. And so I think we saw in the first White House press conference that President Biden held that it looks like, at least so far, White House reporters are looking to go back to the old way of coverage, which wasn't earning much praise before President Trump took office.
Right. There's a lot of different ways in which a presidential administration is covered. Let's talk about that White House press corps, the group that, talks to the press secretary and occasionally the president. Are there ways that could work better?
Yeah, I think there are ways it can work better. One way that a lot of people who teach journalism have been advocating for is to have reporters seek a more outside in method of reporting rather than inside out. And so what that means is that they should probably consider prioritizing insider knowledge of things related to politics as a game less often, right? So they should spend less time cultivating anonymous sources to tell exciting stories about conflict and instead report from the outside in what things about government are working, what things that government does aren't working. And once we have a sense of what those things are, let's ask the president and the president's staff questions about those things rather than things about who's winning and who's losing and are you going to run for reelection and, you know, these sorts of questions that make for maybe good television in terms of ratings, but don't do so much to help us learn about how we should evaluate the job the president is doing.
Along those lines, here's a moment from that press conference last week where President Biden was asked by a CNN reporter whether he was running for re-election in 2024. Here's a bit of that exchange.
You also just made some news by saying that you are going to run for re-election.
I said that is my expectation.
So is that a yes that you are running for re-election?
Look, I don't know where you guys come from, man. I've never been able to travel. I'm a great respecter of fate. I've never been able to plan 4.5, 3.5 years ahead for certain.
And if you do run, will Vice President Harris be on your ticket?
I would fully expect that to be the case. She's doing a great job. She's a great partner.
And do you believe you'll be running against former President Trump?
Oh, come on. I have no idea.
So where does that fit in, Mike, on the news value versus, in-depth coverage of policy that you were just talking about?
Well, if the basis is news value versus something else, I guess I would put it at whatever the lowest score could be. there's virtually no value to asking somebody less than 100 days into their term if they're going to run for re-election. And if they are they going to keep their vice president on the ticket? Especially when, you know, the president said, look, I plan on it and I plan on keeping the vice president on the ticket. No one can predict the future. Right. And the reason that politicians are cagey, or at least one reason that they're cagey when they get questions like that is, you know, let's imagine that some terrible thing comes out about someone in the Biden administration and the media says, oh, but you said you were going to keep them as your secretary of state or as your vice president. But then they did this awful thing. that's why people don't make hard commitments, because instead of responding to circumstance, reporters use it as an example to show hypocrisy when it isn't always the case. And so politicians are really risk averse when they answer questions. The risk aversion is read as they're being evasive by journalists, and the tension between politicians not wanting to make a commitment about seeing the future and the tension that journalists see, and you're not answering my question, give us this never-ending spin cycle of, are you going to run again? Are you not? You said you were going to run, or maybe you won't. And none of this stuff has anything to do with how many Americans are getting vaccinated with the vaccines that might help stop the spread of the coronavirus, or are related to, you know, whether we'll have economic growth or better education or improved race relations, or anything else that we might look to the president to try to help solve as the head of the executive branch of our government.
Talking to Mike Wagner, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, looking at the relationship between presidents and the media, how it's changed over the years. And Mike, I keep thinking back. I read this biography of Franklin Roosevelt by H.W. Brands, and he paints a picture of these press meetings, the president meeting with reporters, not being broadcast, and the president literally saying, here's the thing, you can report that in my name. Here's the thing, say senior administration official. Here's the thing, I'm telling you, you can't report that. And reporters did it. They like did what he said, because if they didn't do it, they wouldn't be let into the room. I'm hoping we at least have somewhat more of a confrontational situation now. That seems like too much of an extreme there. Can you talk some about that and how it's changed over the years?
Yeah, that's something that in many ways has changed from the days of FDR, when people would come in, sit around the desk in the Oval Office and you know, have some things on the record, some off, some as an anonymous source. And that was very much part of his own leadership style. And he also played favorites in the press and would punish reporters who wrote things that he perceived as negative. But these are things that the presidents continue to do. I mean, there were times when Bill Clinton was president, when a White House reporter would quote a senior White House official familiar with the president's thinking. And sometimes that senior White House official familiar with the president's thinking was the president at the time. And so there are still times when a president will talk to reporters and on an agreement that comes before the conversation or before the sharing of news, that the reporter can't use the president's name. But yeah, we have a much more, I would say, adversarial with the president set of White House reporters than we had in the era of FDR.
Now, we've been talking about kind of the White House press corps so far, and that's just one part of the coverage of the executive branch of government. What do you think about the role of the investigative reporting, the reporters who are out there on particular beats, whether that's immigration or health or whatever? Do you see more of that? What did you call it? The outside in reporting?
I do see more of that. I see a lot of reporters taking seriously how well government is performing in the sectors that reporters are assigned to cover on their beats. And I think that over the past couple of decades, many journalists have become much more sophisticated with respect to how they engage with academic research, policy reporting, long-term career professionals who serve in the bureaucracy and work across presidential administrations. These are often really, really valuable sources for reporters. And I've seen in healthcare, for example, in immigration, it's starting to change with respect to race in the United States. We're seeing more and more journalists get more sophisticated, expand the roster of people they're willing to talk to that goes beyond just the political insiders and the partisan politicians with the most power. And so there's a lot of excellent reporting happening at the national level, and especially, in some state houses, for example. You know, there's excellent local reporting that's incredibly vibrant, that's also critical to our understanding of how the world's working.
Flipping things around, what do you make, still early days, but what do you make of the Biden administration and their level of transparency and media access? I know some criticism over up till recently giving media access to some of the border control facilities, the overcrowded ones. What are you looking at when it comes to the Biden administration and transparency?
Well, I would say that in many respects, the Biden administration has been very transparent. The press briefings are They contain much more policy detail than the press briefings did in the Trump era. They're also a little quicker for my read to get back to reporters on questions than even in the Obama era. I will also say, though, that President Biden is like other presidents and other presidential administrations, where access is given more readily when the administration thinks it's going to make them look good, and access is given less readily or is obfuscated when the administration thinks it's going to make them look bad. And so in that regard, I would say that the Biden administration isn't that different from most presidential administrations in how they try to handle news media access.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, looking at the role of the media in covering the presidency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want reporters to do when they're covering the White House, whether that's the White House press corps, the ones asking the questions of a press secretary or the president, or investigative journalists or people on the beat? What matters to you in reporting on President Biden and his administration? Do you want to see the White House, the current occupant, or in general, be more transparent with the press? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Mike Wagner, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, looking at the role of the media in covering the presidency after President Biden held his first official press conference last week. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Andy joins us in Manitowoc. Andy, hello.
Hello there.
Oh, what'd you want to bring up, Andy?
I just wanted to state that I don't understand how your guest there could say that they're more transparent than other administrations. I feel that they're much less transparent, that many of the things that are brought up by the press seem to be one-sided. They seem to only bring up the things that maybe they agree with the Biden administration, and there doesn't seem to be much of the debate, I'll say, on the other side.
And by they, you mean the media in particular, the people covering the president, Andy?
I think, yes, it's the media as well as any in the administration. The administration obviously is going to be one-sided, but I believe that Biden has surrounded himself with one-sided people, and that they don't question his policies and look for, I'll say, compromises or middle-of-the-road kind of answers, so
got
that
it.
You know, not half the country is addressed.
Andy, thanks a lot for that call. So looking at the media side of what he said there, Mike, he sees, I think, members of the media not really calling President Biden to account, more sympathetic or aligned with him in some ways.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the caller made the case to persuade me. So during the one press conference that Biden has had, he was roundly criticized for waiting so long to have a press conference. And he was asked lots of questions about immigration. He was asked lots of questions about detaining children and families at the border. He was asked about why the news media weren't being given access to that, and took a lot of criticism there. He also was asked a lot of questions about whether he supported changing or ending the filibuster in the Senate, which may be required if Democrats want to have a successful legislative campaign in the Senate. And so he was asked lots of questions about things that he would have preferred not to talk about. And he was asked no questions about the thing he wanted to talk about, which was the way that the vaccines have been spread out throughout the United States and how people are beginning to become vaccinated against the coronavirus. Biden was hoping to answer lots of questions about COVID-19 and was asked exactly zero questions about that during his press conference. And so it's just not the case that the news media tend to ask questions that favor issues that they agree with. They ask questions about things they know are going to raise controversy. And right now, the issues that raise controversy are voting rights, immigration, and the filibuster. And those are the things he was asked about at his press conference.
Thanks for calling in, Andy. We'll go to Daryl now in Couderay. Daryl, hi.
Hi. My comment would be, I think President Biden needs to invite the American people of all colors and creeds to participate in overcoming the institutional racism and the cultural racism that is and has been plaguing all America from sea to shining sea. And two simple questions could start this topic out. First question, who gets to pick their parents? Second question, who gets to pick their color?
Daryl, thanks for calling in. Daryl has a specific issue in mind, Mike, but also that idea of the president using the bully pulpit, using media appearances to raise awareness of an issue. In this case, Daryl says racial relations. And from fireside chats to Twitter, what are some of the options for a president to do something like that?
So presidents can engage in presidential scholars call going public, where instead of trying to get advancement in their policy goals by persuading members of Congress, they instead travel around to various parts of the country, taking their message to the people, doing satellite interviews with local television news to bring, their message into the homes of the number one source that people use for information, which is local television news. And so that's a strategy presidents can use. President Trump dominated the news cycle by using Twitter. And so when he would go on tweet storms and the audience on Twitter would respond by liking his tweets or retweeting his tweets, or his opponents would respond by, strongly reacting negatively to his tweets, that was catnip to journalists. And they covered that, which then resulted in the news media covering what the president wanted to be covered, things that he wanted to be talking about. And so presidents have social media as a strategy in recent years. They have going public as another one to try to connect with the people. On the caller's specific point, Biden raised that issue in his nomination speech. He raised it in his inaugural address, and he raised it on the night he claimed victory. And so he has talked about that particular issue on multiple occasions. He doesn't get asked about it very often by the news media by comparison, however.
Thanks for the call, Daryl, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mike Wagner, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, looking at presidents and the press. Back to your calls. Frank is with us in Door County. Frank, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm calling in response to the press secretary for the President of the United States. I think that the press secretary has set a certain tone. Obviously, there's an adversarial relationship between the press and of any administration, it's inherent. But the press secretary has been very, she's been honest and forthright as much as she can. Of course, the administration is going to want you to see certain things and hear certain things, but the press secretary's lack of, just telling that she has told the truth, and that is a big difference from the former administration and the relationship between the press and the press secretary who represents the president. If you don't have a press secretary that tells the truth, that relationship between the press secretary and that administration is, of course, diminished. And what we had in the former administration from the get-go was just a lack of not just forthrightness, but honesty.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think it's right that the relationship between the White House press corps and the White House press secretary is one that's built on access and trust. And if the White House press corps does not trust the information they're getting from the press secretary, you're going to have an incredibly contentious and adversarial relationship between the White House press corps and the administration more generally. And I think we certainly saw that during the Trump administration. And I would also agree with the caller that Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary under President Biden, has been a person who has been more forthright with sharing policy details, has been less willing to engage in the partisan battle of the day style of questions that often get asked in these kinds of things. Of course, there are things that the news media would like to know that certainly would be valuable for the audience to also know that she doesn't want to answer. And that is a common trait of White House press secretaries as well. And their job, as the caller pointed out, is to, put the administration's frame on an issue. And so you know, she's definitely an advocate for President Biden, and does not see her job as one where all of the best arguments are brought up and then we decide. Her job is to share the Biden administration's perspective. But she's done so far in a way that's earned pretty positive reviews from White House reporters in terms of the two key issues that matter the most to their work, which is access and trust.
Thanks for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Mike, I know you spent a lot of your research looking at issues of partisanship and the partisan divide and trust in media. Can you talk about what you'd like to see from White House coverage to help rebuild some of the trust we may have lost?
Oh, I think one thing journalists can do is try to spend a little bit more time showing their audience what's under the hood. So explaining to their audience, why are we covering this versus that? Why did we quote these people versus other people we might have quoted? Why do we think these people are credible? A little bit more of that kind of thing can go a long way toward helping to build trust. And then also, of course, reporting on issues that matter to people, right? That's another way to build trust with the news. When we see news stories where the White House press corps, for example, is asking President Biden, so you made these promises when you were running for office, and here is our understanding of the status of those promises. What do you have to say about that? That's valuable for us. And the more that happens, the more we might come to see news organizations as honest brokers. But of course, many of us retreat to our partisan corners and are not only choosing our opinions, but are choosing our facts, which makes the job much more difficult for reporters who are trying to share the verifiable truth with us.
We'll leave it there. Mike, thanks for joining us again.
You bet.
Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He talked with us today about the relationship between the presidency and the press in the early days of the Biden administration. Coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers will be playing in front of hometown fans to start the season, but things aren't quite back to normal. We'll look at how the fan experience is shaping up and maybe get a sneak preview of the Brewers' season along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new program at UW-Eau Claire is helping professors use free open source materials in their classes. We'll hear about that and how a similar effort at UW-Milwaukee has helped students save money on textbooks. Now, one of the most fun days of the year for Wisconsin sports fans arrives tomorrow, opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers. Kristen Yelich, Brandon Woodruff, and the rest of the crew will take on the Minnesota Twins at American Family Field, formerly known as Miller Park. Because of the pandemic, it's going to be a different opening day than we're used to. For one thing, fewer fans in attendance. And if you're actually going to the game or any Brewer home game until further notice, there are several new policies you'll need to follow. Megan Hart is Wisconsin Public Radio's sports reporter. Megan, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, in many ways, last year was a strange year, Megan, including for baseball, just a 60-game season, no fans. How are you feeling as a sports reporter and fan about the return of real big league baseball regular season play?
I'm really excited. I have to say baseball is my favorite sport. And last season I was so happy to have baseball as an outlet during the pandemic. It was a very difficult year, but it was such a short season. And I think part of the beauty of Major League Baseball is the grind of the regular season. So I'm excited to have that back. And I just hope everything goes well and everyone stays safe.
And with that in mind, what are we hearing from the Brewers organization about how they're going to have people in the stands and maintain some safety?
Yeah, so the game tomorrow, they are going to be at 25% capacity with fans. So that's somewhere between 11 and 12,000 people. And tomorrow's game is sold out. the team actually submitted a 500-page document to the Milwaukee Health Department with their safety plan. So they do have a lot in place. Everything in the stadium is going to be cashless. There are no bags allowed to kind of prevent people from having to stick their hands in and search a bunch of spectators' bags. And the team is encouraging fans to download the MLB Ballpark app. They can get their tickets scanned on there. They can even order food for a contactless pickup on the app. So there will be a lot of changes. I think one of the big ones that we'll be able to see on TV is that fans are going to sit sort of in pods with their family or the people they came with. So they'll be able to spread out and socially distance, and masks will be required. So yeah, definitely going to be a different opening day.
Has the team said anything about what the reduced capacity is going to mean for revenue? Obviously one quarter of the people, I'm assuming, means about one quarter of the cash.
Right. Rick Schlesinger is the team's president of business operations. And when he spoke to the media last week, he said he wouldn't give any specifics on revenue losses for this year or for last season when there were no fans at all. But he has said before that the Brewers earn most of their money from the gate and from concession sales and merchandise sales at the stadium. So it is a challenge for small market teams. But I think some good news is that the team was able to bring back almost 900 part-time employees. So it might be still some tough times for the Brewers, but I think it'll help a lot of people in the Milwaukee area.
Now, you went over the guidelines inside the stadium for health behaviors. How about the tailgating?
You know, tailgating, it's such a unique culture for Milwaukee baseball. But unfortunately, it's not going to be allowed at the start of the season. The team, because it depends so much on revenue coming in from fans being able to attend, I don't think they want to do anything to jeopardize the ability to have at least 25% capacity at their games. And another thing that Rick Schlesinger had said was that it's just hard to prevent tailgates from growing from four people trying to do it responsibly to 40 people or more. So at least for now, no tailgating. But he said that the Milwaukee Health Department is aware that tailgating is a big part of Brewers culture. So maybe somewhere down the road that'll come back.
Now, this could be an indoor or outdoor game, depending on the dome. Have they said anything about their dome policies and how much they're going to try to keep them open?
They are going to try to keep the dome open as much as possible because, of course, it is much safer for people to gather outside during the pandemic. But tomorrow, the dome will be closed. It's going to be a very chilly opening day at a high of 36 in Milwaukee.
Now, these are policies for now. Are there any indications of when the Brewers and other teams, for that matter, will look back and revise and come to the health department and say, hey, can we bring that up to 35% or 50% or whatever?
Yeah, so the Brewers originally asked for 35% capacity, and the Milwaukee Health Department came back to them, and they agreed on 25%. That's another area where Schlesinger said that he made it clear to the Milwaukee Health Department. He made sure that they knew there's a Cubs series coming up in mid-April, and it's always good to have as many Brewers fans as possible to cheer against the Cubs. So he seems hopeful that they'll be able to increase that capacity. Of course, it really kind of depends what's going on with the virus. Milwaukee sets those policies based on its own gating criteria, and Wisconsin is progressing with its vaccine campaign, which I think is very helpful for professional sports. But at the same time, I was on Milwaukee County's press briefing yesterday, and Ben Weston, who is their director of their Office of Emergency Management, he said that positive COVID tests in the Milwaukee area were up 45% week over week. So he encouraged people to still take lots of precautions. And I think really what happens with the Brewers and the Bucks and their fan policies will kind of depend on how the virus is trending in the area.
And Megan, we should at least take a minute or so to talk about what's going to happen on the field. What are the Brewers looking like as they want to get into yet another postseason? I think it's going to be four straight. How are they looking coming out of spring training?
Yeah, you know, it's the NL Central, I think, is going to be very competitive this year. The Cardinals are going to be very good. And of course, the Cubs will also be competitive. So, I think it'll be a fun season. Brandon Woodruff is going to be the starting pitcher tomorrow. And last season, pitching and defense seemed to win a lot of games for the Brewers. So I think the real question is whether their offense will rebound and Christian Yelich will come back and have a better year. And they can make a run for the wild card or even the division.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio's sports reporter based in Green Bay. We talked to her about what fans can expect at tomorrow's Milwaukee Brewers home opener against the Minnesota Twins. Among the changes, no tailgating, wear that mask, order your concessions through an app, and only about 12,000 fans in attendance. First pitch is at 1:10. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a poem about a natural disaster's destruction from a Wisconsin native.
When Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and surrounding islands in 2017, it was devastating. The storm tore through communities, decimated cities and towns, and brought on widespread power outages. Countless people were injured, and more than 3,000 people died. Rebuilding in the aftermath has been slow and frustrating for its residents, as many have criticized the government's response. As Puerto Ricans living in the United States watched the disaster from afar, many felt powerless. It was hard to reach their family members and assist in a meaningful way. Poet Carl Michael Iglesias wanted to help in a way only he could. So the Milwaukee native and Brooklyn resident channeled his thoughts into a debut poetry collection, Catch a Glow. He shares the poem Shuttered New, which he created from a series of newspaper clippings. Iglesias says it's about the mass exodus of students from Puerto Rico and the teachers who were left behind. Take a listen.
Shuttered New. Education announced closure. Schools erased in endless summer, taking into account sharp drop in enrollment amid island economic slump, families' departure, and American desks. Today, English only. First winter coat, New York radiator hiss, tropic piping haunting, fever that opens windows in January. In the coming weeks, Miss Torres to lose her job, joined strike in the mayhem after the police fire tear gas and pepper spray to end, gathered to oppose, decimate what remained, more to leave. We're overwhelmed, said the need to express our indignation. People who are suffering march down Gold Mile, heart of the financial district, bank buildings, glass high rises. They won't stop us, salsa blared. Scuffle in riot gear before a drizzle briefly dampened wooden shields, dressed in charcoal, covering faces with bandanas, tear gas. Chaos has been arrested and injured, covering windows with plywood and hurricane shutters. Standoff with police who fired downward. Spiral wrath, judge handling the island's bankruptcy, an entity not elected by the people. We found out from the press.
That was Milwaukee native Carl Michael Iglesias sharing the poem Shuttered New. He tells us about the inspiration behind the poem.
The inspiration behind the poem Shuttered New is the shuttering of hundreds of schools in Puerto Rico around the same time as Hurricane Maria. Post-Maria, over 40 schools were damaged so bad that they couldn't reopen. At the same time, I'm teaching a bilingual poetry class for middle schoolers in Brooklyn, and I welcome two students from Puerto Rico who moved in with the family in New York in order to go back to school. I was witnessing the diaspora in motion, and it was clear how Puerto Ricans were all a degree away from being affected by the hurricane. To dive into this moment a little bit more, I used snippets of newspaper clippings to compile parts of the poetic narrative. What inspires me the most to create is this self-realization that I have the responsibility to tell the story of my people, my histories, my family. It's my job to comment about the times and the moment around me, to try to document what it feels like to be alive. My book of poetry, Catch a Glow, is an exploration of how the Puerto Rican diaspora digested the effects of Hurricane Maria through journalism, the supernatural, and the people affected by it on the island and hundreds of miles away.
Carl Michael Iglesias is a poet, teacher, and actor based in Brooklyn. He grew up in Milwaukee and is a graduate of UW-Madison. His debut collection of poetry, Catch a Glow, was released earlier this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we hear about programs at two UW campuses that are helping students save money on textbooks by using open source materials. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, college comes with a lot of costs beyond tuition. One that can add up quickly is textbooks. A new pilot program at UW-Eau Claire is looking to help students save money by working with professors to use free open source materials in their classes this summer. And UW-Milwaukee started a similar initiative in 2016. Two of the people behind these open source projects join us now. Jill Markgraf is Director of Libraries at UW-Eau Claire. Jill, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Diane Reddy is Professor of Psychology and Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Milwaukee. Diane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, Diane, can you talk about the origins of your project from back in 2016? What led you to try to seek out these open source projects?
The origin is actually all about the students. It's about creating equity for the students. So often we knew that some of our students were unable to purchase the resources that they needed in a course, such as the required textbook, and we wanted to do something about that. So that was our origin, to make sure that students have the resources that they need. Students may be economically disadvantaged. They may have many circumstances why they are unable to purchase a textbook, and they're concerned about their grade, but they want to, have that resource, but they can't. So that's why we started out.
And Jill, this is the second summer semester with this program. Can you talk about how it is working using open sources for these selected classes at UW-Eau Claire?
We started a pilot project last summer where we incentivized some faculty to incorporate open educational resources into their course design over the summer, and then to offer those courses in the fall. Then we could assess their experience and their students' experience with using those resources. It was very successful, so we're going to be offering it again this coming summer. Among some of the things that the students really responded to with this project were they found that the OER resources were much more engaging and relevant and timely and than some of the textbooks they had used in the past. And of course, they appreciated the fact that they weren't paying for them.
And Diane, talk about, I picture buying a big textbook or maybe some smaller books. Nowadays, I imagine we're purchasing electronic books for our classes, electronic textbooks. What do the open source materials look like? What kind of things do we end up with in a class?
We end up with a textbook and digital resources that are of very high quality. I had a textbook that cost $170 before I switched to open educational resources. And students enjoy the digital textbook. They don't have an access code, which is so important today because so many students during this COVID situation have unreliable home internet. So they don't need an access code. They can get to these materials, and they can download it on their computer oftentimes, and that's very useful.
And Jill, can you talk about, Diane, can you talk about the reliability of these open source textbooks? How do we know we're getting stuff that's reliable in the same way that the textbooks we usually use are?
That's a good question, and I think it points to the reason that some campuses, some instructors have been reluctant to adopt OER, as we call them. But they really run the gamut. There's a lot out there. In the early days, there wasn't as much. And I think some instructors had bad experiences and were concerned about the quality. But now with the proliferation of open content out there, there's some really excellent quality materials. But the hard part is finding it and finding the good stuff. And as a part of our project at UW-Eau Claire, that's where the library faculty came in. That's their expertise, really, in helping locate reliable materials. So it was a project that had librarians partnering with instructors and with instructional designers.
Talking to Jill Margraf, Director of Libraries at UW-Eau Claire, and Diane Reddy from UW-Milwaukee, Professor of Psychology there and Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning, talking about ongoing pilot projects to use open source material in some classes to save students a lot of money on textbooks for those classes. Diane, you've been at this for a while now. Could you talk about how the availability of these good and hopefully good quality sources has changed over that time?
Well, it actually has increased steadily in terms of quality. In the very beginning, I'd agree with Jill that, you know, it depended on the resource that you were using, but they really are of high quality. And it's just a different funding model. Originally, you know, people made textbooks and then they're going to sell them. Well, now the authors are basically the same people, the same faculty as I am, who are authoring the textbooks, but they're paid up front by a grant, a foundation, to produce that high-quality resource. And they also go through the exact same peer review. And they wouldn't last, just like a commercial textbook doesn't last. People don't buy it. People wouldn't be using it. So in my disciplinary area, there are many options, and they're high quality. And it has an impact for the students, that's for sure. In terms of having that resource in your hands on the very first day of class, that sets you up for success. And also, the data is there to show, also related to quality, that it has an impact not only on student engagement, as Jill noted, but also then on their success in the course, their academic success. We systematically examined this. Not only is there published studies out there that show this, that the learning is equivalent, at least equivalent, but also on our own campus at UWM, when we compared students who had the open textbook with the same instructors teaching, you know, in the past with the commercial textbook, there was earlier engagement because they had the resource and greater success. So it's been a great situation at UWM with 18,981 students impacted and saving students $2.3 million in savings that would have been spent on commercial textbooks.
Jill, at UW-Eau Claire, you've done some piloting on this. Are you looking to expand the use of these open educational resources in the future?
Well, we certainly hope so. You know, based on the positive response to our pilot, there's interest again in doing it again in the summer. We really do rely on faculty talking to each other and encouraging them to do it. But one thing we realize, in order to expand the program even further beyond an individual faculty member here or there, that we have to be committed to the adoption of OER as an institution. If you think about one of the challenges is that traditional textbook publishers make it really, really easy for faculty to use their textbooks. You know, they market directly to faculty. They package things really nicely in a way that saves faculty a lot of time. And we know that it takes time to make the transition to OER and to update them, to revise them, to incorporate them into your course. And that was part of our project, was recognizing that it would take additional effort from our faculty. So could we incentivize them to make that effort to the advantage of their students? So that's what we're hoping. And we also recognize that faculty they're busy people. They have to make priorities, and they are expected to publish, to engage in scholarship, to engage in service, heavy teaching loads. And so in order to have them prioritize adopting OER, we need to value that activity in the tenure and review process. So I think in order to move forward, we're going to have to take it to that next level.
And Diane, just in our last half minute or so, are you starting to get faculty now coming to you saying, yeah, I want to do this too?
Absolutely, because the word is out. And I think that faculty care and they want to support students. And they're willing to invest that effort, particularly if there is an incentive or recognition for that effort that they are putting in to make these resources for their students or adopt the resources for their students.
We'll leave it there. Diane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jill, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Jill Markgraf is Director of Libraries at UW-Eau Claire. Diane Reddy, Professor of Psychology and Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the use of open source class materials in some classes to help students save on textbooks. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's the week in Washington. We'll learn more about President Biden's infrastructure plan he talked about today in Pittsburgh. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.